Do we want to first start whether there's any particular things on individual talks that people want to probe with individual speakers?
Frank Glenn from the London School of Economics. I'm going to make what probably something which is not a very helpful comment. We've had a number of people, in a sense, trying to pin down what information is, what one thinks about information. But what comes across to me is the slipperiness of the concept and the difficulty we face in really trying to come to grips with it. Merely simply because there are many different ways of thinking about it. There are many possible definitions. And I hope that by the end of this conference, perhaps we're a little bit closer to solving the problem of the slipperiness.
Christian Voigt from the Center for Social Innovation in Vienna. I would actually like to continue the suggestion, but question the need for this shared interpretation of information, because we were talking about models and we said models have a purpose and they have a community. So if models have a purpose and a community and all communities are different most likely defined by the purpose they serve, then why would we need this shared grand definition of information? Maybe we are just fine with a set of multiple information definitions. And I suppose you said there is the concept of family resemblance. So this is maybe the most we can hope for.
Robin Fichtney, if I could respond to that. That comment seems to imply very well-insulated communities that for some people at least here that there's an implicit desire to come together, bring the communities together, and to whatever extent that might be possible.
I think there are two distinctions to make. Simon D'Alfonso, University of Melbourne. One is, is it some sort of group of related concepts or something that we're trying to bring together? Or is it just, we're just trying to explain, why is there this one word, information, that people just seem to be, putting everywhere these days? And they're two different things, right? For example, like with Shannon's sort of stuff, could you just say what he was actually dealing with was data, for example, or just something like that? That, it's the word or the concept?
A number of concepts. So if we talk about information, it's probably hard to separate it from the different notions that go with that word. And if you take Shannon, then you have a set of physically oriented concepts taken from natural science, like waves, etc. And if you come from semiotics, then you have another set of associations. And even if I say, I'm not anti-unification, I'm just wondering to what degree would it help us? I mean, at what stage would someone from philosophy actually need concepts coming from Shannon's theory? Or is it just fine if the two, the physicist and the philosopher go on following their own streams of thoughts?
Jeff Parsons, I'm from Memorial University in Canada. And on this question, two comments. First of all, on this question of using the same word but meaning, having different senses of what we're talking about, I think this is very interesting to me because it's a very interdisciplinary conference. I come from the domain of information systems, so we have a particular view of information and so on. And I'm learning a lot from different areas. But I think the key thing for me is if there is some commonality, then this is a good venue in which to sort of abstract to a common level where we can have some shared conception. And if there isn't, then it's fine, at least as long as we're aware that, you know, it's in information theory in Shannon, it's quite different from what I do and what I'm interested in. But it's good to be aware of that and to define the boundaries one way or the other. But the other point I'd like to make is, in all this discussion of what is information, it seems to me that there's one glaring omission of what information means, at least to me. In the domain of information systems, one sort of common view, or one view, I wouldn't say common, view of what an information system is, it's a representation, typically in a computer, of some kind of perceived external real world or other system. And I use the word perceived here, it's very importantly, because in an information system, what we build and the artifact that we create represents some human's understanding of some real world process or domain or whatever. So the whole issue of cognition and how people process process, how people think, is extremely critical, I think, to understand to any kind of discussion of what information is. And maybe there'll be some of that later, at least in my own presentation tomorrow. But I think that's one aspect that it sort of came out, you talked about mind, but in one of the presentations there, but I think there's more to it than that.
In information, this sort of discussion is somewhat unsatisfactory because, in fact, we had this discussion already in the case of energy a long time ago. Obviously, you have very many different shapes or forms of energy, but you have some sort of theoretical nucleus which pins down what is actually energy and what is not, independent of everyday language use, which is completely different. So that is the same with information. Information obviously has different forms and shapes and so on, but if you have a certain consensus about the fact that information is physical, then obviously the idea would be to have some parameters or some sort of description of formal type which is parallel to the discussion of energy. Otherwise, it's not very useful because then you could not even couple information to entropy. And, of course, this asks for a clarification of concepts. For instance, as we just heard that information, physical information, is conserved, I would not actually agree to that because, obviously, entropy is not conserved, but structural entropy or the structural part of information is something else. So you could speak of conservation only if you could pin down the result that the complete entropy of both parts is actually equal to zero, which is the case for the total energy in the universe. So, of course, it is necessary to discuss these concepts in detail, but this does not actually mean, and therefore I'm not very pessimistic. I'm known as an optimistic fan of unified theory of information. I would say, well, we start as we usually start, namely on the level of physics, going up the hierarchy of evolutionary levels, and will then obviously find that we're on each level talking about different shapes and forms, but about the same concept, hopefully.
I'm Björn Neve from KTH, Stockholm. I would like to, in the answer to Christian, very much second your opinion that abstraction is a good thing. When several communities meet, we try to find commonalities that are on an abstract level that helps us to situate each other. But also, as a mathematician, I'd like to point to the fact that mathematics has, through the ages, fought a long and hard historical battle to get rid of meaning and transform itself into pure form. As Hermann Weyl says, one of the great mathematicians of the last century, there comes a point when we forget what the symbols stand for. And that's when we enter mathematics. Now, in parallel to this, there has been a change in definitions from existential definitions, what is it, to operational definitions. How does it behave? So that might be an interesting thing to think about. thinking of information less in terms of what it is than in terms of how does it behave. So we use it sort of like a primitive concept, like points and lines in geometry, for instance. Nobody defines a point. A point gives two lines, a line gives two points. And this gives a freedom to put anything in there that satisfies these formal structures. So that might be a way of thinking of information as well.
If I could just, we work together. And what we're working on is on the future of various things, education futures. But if I think in terms of information, and we were to come back next year or in 5 years, what would the future of the kind of work that we're hearing about, what would that look like? So seeing how things evolve, we've heard from the history, but if we were to forecast, what might we be considering would be interesting?
Mustafa, were you...
Mustafa Ali, based at the Open University. My comments are really on the first and I think third presentation, which were to do with the unified theory of information. There was mention in there about a kind of emergent materialism, and you presented a kind of phenomenal hierarchy leading up from, if you like, energy through matter, through biology, mind, to the noosphere, etc. One of the things that worries me about these kind of semiotic formulations is that they don't seem to really take seriously the scale and enduring impact of the mind-body problem, which has been around for a very long time, particularly in its recent formulations, the hard problem, going back to the work of people like Dave Chalmers, who's brought it back into center stage in the philosophy of mind. And I'm thinking specifically in terms of its formulation, going back to somebody like Thomas Nagel, what is it like to be a bat, the idea of qualia, first-personhood experience. This kind of also, I guess, leads me to think about the final presentation, which broadly takes a kind of Dennettian type take on the whole issue of intentionality. But as Dennett's critics have pointed out, you know, he is he actually explaining consciousness? Is he explaining the hard problem? Or is he explaining it away by reformulating it in terms of models which are fundamentally artifacts and hence third person relative to a first person cognizer? So just be interested in hearing what people have to say about the issue of consciousness, first personhood, and the hard problem. Thanks.
Anybody want to pick up on that perhaps from the panel?
I guess I'm sort of obliged to. this is quite a deep and difficult issue. There's no doubt about that. I have to say that the so-called hard problem has been one of my main interests for many years. And in fact, what I presented today is I didn't say anything about it at the time, but it is intended as a solution to the hard problem. The relevant point is about mental content, about that being identified or at least classified as intentional information, and that being seen as encoded in physical information or material form. Now, I sort of grind to a halt at that point because I'd like to know how you react to that.
I've also done some work in philosophy of mind, and I kind of stopped working in it because of the hard problem. Broadly, I skated around two possible solutions, at least for me, because I wasn't convinced by any of the standard eliminative materialist, dualist, or other frameworks. So the positions that I thought actually had some merit and worth exploring were essentially pan-experientialism, or some version of panpsychism, that at the most primitive level, ontological level of the universe, there is some experiential component, in the same way that we seem to be projecting back information down the phenomenal hierarchy. I was led to the view that possibly we might want to project back experience in some kind of a proto-experiential form, at least. The other one was an emergent framework, of the type presented by, I think, the first and third presentations. But I wasn't convinced by that either. And there's a very interesting paper by a guy named, I think, Jim Van Cleve, entitled Mind Dust or Magic. And that seems to sum up the two possibilities, that if you go for a kind of a panpsychist view, essentially you're talking about the dust of the universe, the most primitive ontological substrate of the universe, essentially being experiential, a form of mind dust. The other alternative is simply magic. As the abstract states, and I'm interested to see and hear a possible explanation other than a simple descriptive statement that, you know, one appeals to a kind of historical dialectic to say, okay, we can't derive consciousness from the biological. And I think that was stated in the abstract. So there's no way of logically deriving consciousness from the biological, yet consciousness emerges from the biological. And I want to know, what does that actually mean, other than a kind of holding up of the hand and saying, hey, presto, it happens. So it seems to me that those kind of emergent frameworks are fine descriptively, but they don't cash out in any explanatory terms.
May I take... Hello? Hello? Do you hear me? Okay. Yes? I think the assumption underlying your statement is that you would like to have an explanation. And an explanation in a very strict form, which says, here are causes, and these causes lead to these effects. And only if you have this, then you would be satisfied. And the problem is that it is not possible to have in every case of instances of objects we want to understand in our world, these simple, I would say now simple, a scheme of causes and effects, because this would be a deterministic universe, and this cannot exist. Therefore, emergence is not magic. Magic would mean you don't know what how A and B are related, and therefore A could also be related to C or to D or whatever. So this is magic, because everything can be the case. But emergentism doesn't say that everything can be the case. It says exactly that there are preconditions, and that preconditions have to be met in order to give a kind of bandwidth of possible solutions, or of solutions how evolution could go on. So what you have is a less than strict determinism, which says there are things which are impossible, given certain circumstances, but there are many, many things which are possible. But which is realized in evolution, we cannot say, because it depends on things which cannot be reduced to simple causes and effects, because there is something like freedom of action or whatever, which then develops into the free will at the human level. So this is what I would want to say a pro for the emergentist side.
Yeah, I would perhaps just like to add that, in fact, I see that as, I mean, being a philosopher myself, I see that as a problem of the philosophical approach, in fact, because I think that most of the approaches in analytic philosophy have the problem of being anthropomorphic in their questioning, you know. This is clearly demonstrated in circling all the time about the problem. Mary tells Tom the following, and Tom tells Mary the following, and so on, and later, after years, we come to the idea that Tom has understood something, and so, but that is actually not the point. The point is that on the fundamental level, we talk about something which is actually not human, you see, and nevertheless, only humans are around at the time being. I'm not talking of the future of other planets, but so far as we know, only humans on this very planet are around, to make models of that. That is a problem, because everything we do, we have to reflect internally, so to speak, in human terms. And these human terms are derived from our biological capacity of perception and cognition. So obviously we are limited. And this means that the information, or rather the knowledge we extract, is always limited. And therefore it's quite obvious that we have the result Wolfgang has pointed to, namely that we are not able to order causes and effects appropriately. So the problem is that this is actually not the original idea. You see, human beings can only reflect because that is a kind of selective advantage they have as compared to other living beings on this planet, and this will help to them to survive better than otherwise. So it's not a question of truth, it's simply a question what is functioning and what is not functioning. And therefore, these models are limited, and we are not talking about magic or anything like that, you see. We simply talk about the possibility of putting models into an epistemologically consistent form. Consistency and contingency, these two aspects are actually determining what we are doing all the time.
So my name is Jan Schliefer. I'm coming from Bern, University of Applied Sciences. And I wanted to maybe continue the way of thinking of Jeff, yes? About information, where does it come from? Because when we speak about material form of information, we normally think about already coded information, that we have something, you know, some sort of true sentence, and we code it in on the hard disk, on a piece of paper, in our brain or whatever. But how do we extract this information? Because on the lowest level, there's something like the state of the universe of every molecule, what, by the way, thanks to Heisenberg, is unknown, cannot be known. And then we extract something that is relevant for us, and we cannot have the complete information about the universe, because it is impossible to represent the state in a system that is the state of a system, for example, in our brain that is part of the system, or any computer or anything. And the thing is that we extract the information that is relevant, and for everybody, the other piece of information is relevant. And where is the real source of information? I thought about it, and for example, if you see Antarctic ice, first it is just ice. If you have a method to make an ice core, you have the code of the, for example, the evolution of the climate on the Earth. So the very process of extracting information to some set of meaningful sentences, this is something that is very, very, very subjective. Okay, stop.
I think we sometimes get sidetracked a little bit into trying to dream up taxonomies of information. I'm not sure quite how productive it is. There was a book a few years ago by Alfred Borgman, and it happens that I've got a quote here, and he distinguishes between information about reality, and he would include things like records and topography, and he calls that natural. It's a bit like we had in one of the papers. And then he talks about information for reality, and he talks about recipes and musical scores and circuit diagrams. And then something that we haven't had so far today, I think, he talks about information as reality, so it might be a computer program or a CD, and it's information as commodity. Now, I think all this is quite interesting. It's sometimes useful, particularly the way that information as a commodity has evolved hugely in the last decades, but I'm not sure whether any of that actually helps us understand any more about the nature of information or a nature of information. I think I would go back to, if you actually want to have something that's hard and fast, I think you've got to go back to the Shannon definition, which is really what you were saying about mathematics with not much meaning. And it's quite interesting because when Shannon's paper was translated into Russian, a mathematical theory of communication became a statistical theory of electrical signal transmission.
And one of the reasons for that was that at that time in the Soviet Union, it just was not acceptable to use words like information and communication in connection with technological artifacts, because they were considered to be things that were associated with human beings. The word entropy was put into quotation marks. And so that actually sort of did really try to reduce any anthropomorphic consequences of that. And I think possibly quite rightly, because I think Shannon really is, it is really a statistical theory of transmission. It's not really a mathematical theory of communication at all. So I think the Russians were quite right in this particular case. And I think that that's probably the only thing we can say hard and fast about definition of information. That's not to say that all the rest of it isn't interesting, but it's more part of social sciences than it is of engineering.
If you quoted, you know, the Soviet approach, so I was born in Poland, and we had a short philosophical dictionary, and there was cybernetics, and it started with reactionary pseudoscience, and so on and so on. I was thinking about, for example, you know, where a hieroglyphic text doesn't have information if nobody can understand it. You know, I mean, now the extraction of some facts that you can name from the environment, it has to be selected, then it may be coded, transmitted, and so on. But some people say information is just in the universe. Some people say how many bits there are in the universe. And what does it mean?
Okay, Simon?
I would say that, did you use the example of the Rosetta Stone? Is that what you just... Sorry. Hieroglyphics you are. You mentioned hieroglyphics, didn't you? Hieroglyphics, you mentioned...
Yeah.
Okay. I think an example was given that you're talking about a semantics independent of any informe. So a similar example would be the Rosetta Stone. Would you say that the information existed before a translation method was discovered?
This is exactly a question.
Okay, I would
because the information, I mean, the meaning of the text existed definitely in the Egyptian times.
Yeah.
It definitely existed after Champollion. And in the meantime, what happened to it? Or for example, the Fifth Symphony of Beethoven. If every score disappears, if every musician dies out, does it exist or not? It's just a question. I don't know the answer.
Yeah, I would say that it does exist. It's a bit like that. If a forest falls in the tree, is there anyone there to hear it? It's a little similar. I should actually just have a quick question. Do most people here think that information is a third category extra to matter and energy?
That is a good question. I was thinking that because, of course, it's something that people have been saying for a long, long time.
Who was it? Norbert Wiener? Was it Norbert Wiener? I thought that was the whole beauty of information, that it's sort of a like functionalism or something. It's really just the function that counts, the instructions, whatever. So I never really thought that a physical instantiation was necessary for information. It was more the abstraction.
How can the abstraction have any effect without physical...
Well, it doesn't. So it does, like, to have an effect, it does, but for there to be something, a notion of information, it can be abstracted from its physical implementation.
Well, if I have understood that correctly, you would ask whether it's actually necessary at all to attach information to the physical environment. In fact, I think it is absolutely necessary because energy does not tell you how to organize things. And if you think that the universe altogether is a system, then it shall be organized. But, of course, it must know somehow, you know, how to organize. And that is the other side. I mean, energy gives you the potential to do things, and information tells you how to do them.
Maybe following up on this, you mentioned earlier this notion of non-natural meaning. So how would this sit with the fact that, especially with non-natural meaning, we can create conventions, and we can basically, to any object in the universe, we can assign any meaning we want if we decide to. So we can say, okay, if I put this microphone here, that means that the meeting is finished. It's completely said that's completely arbitrary. It doesn't. How does that somehow connect to the physical reality? And there's still that information I could have conveyed it in many different other ways if I had somebody else or a community where we decide, okay, this is now our convention. So I would say that seems to suggest that there does seem to be some kind of gap between information and its physical realizations on the other hand.
But should we get one more from me?
Just an observation, really. Roger, if you're
open. It seems to me from the discussions that information is a concept or a construct, and it's there whether we know it's there or not, and it can be lost and found. There's all sorts of stuff around it. Fascinating topic. I think the nature of our conversations is a product of where we are in history. I don't know if other people want to add or comment on that. So it's contextual and contingent.
Did you want to say more, Raina?
I was actually referring to the to your remark. I think the meaning which is decided upon in the sciences or even in the arts or so is not actually arbitrary, because I think that we are following certain boundary conditions which define certain constraints on what we can actually usefully build a consensus around. So, I mean, if thinking about energy, each week, you know, a couple of years ago, I've received a letter from people who explained to me that they can produce more energy out of something which has less energy. And I said, no, actually, I don't believe this. And, of course, it turned out after a while that they had committed some sort of error. And you see, the point is that there is the limit where the scientific consensus is telling you that energy is a concept, first of all, and is a meaningful concept, but does not have arbitrary meaning, so that even a large group of people who believe in perpetuum mobile, they cannot be successful in terms of models. You know.
I would agree with that, but I think I would distinguish between, on the one hand, the constraints of what meanings are possible in the level of information, and on the other hand, the possibilities of assigning meaning to physical objects. So I can only maybe have a particular set of possible meanings I can use, but I'm not that doesn't constrain me in terms of how I then encode those in a physical carrier, like a sentence in English or in Turkish or in German or a movement of my hands. I mean, that relation seems to be to a great extent arbitrary.
But if you would like to communicate with others, then obviously you are underlying certain boundary conditions.
Yes, I guess it would have to be perceptible by the others, but otherwise I don't see.
Physics puts some constraints on information in this world. But what about sort of mathematics and logic and stuff like that? Presumably the physical realm, maybe it does. I mean, these are deep philosophical questions. Is mathematics, you know, independent of the physical world and things like that? No, it's not.
No, it's not, because, I mean, biology, you know, is a result of physics, and mathematics is a result of biology, because you need a mathematician first. So,
question, is information independent? For me, information is always about a mapping between things. It's like in mathematics, you have sets, and then you have functions between sets, and then you have functions between these functions, and so on and so on. This is fundamental, because we're using explanations to me, is just a mapping between one metaphor and another. And what we choose to believe in, what we choose to take as primitive, are concepts and relations between them that we feel good about, that we have learned to accept, that serve a certain purpose within a certain context for a certain target group, like a model. So basically, we're building these things and we're building mappings between them and climbing on extreme levels of abstractions without even being aware of it. So that's where information lives, not on the thing level, but on the mapping between things.
I'm José María Díaz from the University of León, Spain. I would like to guess what I think it could be a way to reduce some of the oppositions or contradictions between different positions about the nature of information. And I'm thinking that one of the differences between the different points of view, it's concerning the consideration of open or closed universes of discourse. So, for example, when we look for consistency in order to provide so the truthfulness of information, we are considering some kind of closed universe. When we are trying to seek into the evolution of systems, we are considering so an open universe of discourse. One of the things that we wanted to discuss in the presentation of Reinhard Zimmermann that I will continue tomorrow is considering the point of view of Floridi. We have discussed many times so about the position of Floridi, and he gives so two kinds of elements in a communication in communication that wouldn't be information. For example, when we have some contradiction, or when we have something that is opposite to the truth. So in one of the cases we would have so no information, and in the other case he liked to speak about a negative information. So I think that from the perspective of closed epistemic systems, he is right because a contradiction is impossible, and this contradiction cannot be within the universe of discourse. It's out of discourse. It's like saying nothing. But from the perspective of an open epistemic system, then a contradiction is possible, and it brings a lot of meaning because it could say to us that our universe of understanding is wrong. So we need a new model, and we have to jump from one epistemic world to another. So we need an evolution in our epistemic system. So it brings a whole amount of information, and considering the negative value of information. So, for example, when something is not the case, but is completely sustainable from our epistemic system, it could so from the point of view of the closed epistemic system, so it's clear that it's not referring a real situation, and we could say, okay, that is not giving us so a correct representation of this situation. So it's wrong. It's worse. It's even worse than information because it's bringing us a wrong representation of the real situation. But in a pragmatic situation or from an open point of view, we would see, okay, this person is lying, and we get a different meaning from that. So, for example, that this is not, this person is not in a communicative situation, so it has a pragmatic value. So what I mean between this closed and open universe of discourse, so this discussion or these differences is that we can relate so these different perspectives. We cannot get close in a into a given modelization of the world. We need an open modelization of the world if we are thinking in evolutionary terms. So it's just a guess. And I think this kind of distinction could bring us some point of commonality, because we would be agree so that if we consider a set of propositions like right, like if they were correct, okay, we need some kind of consistency. But if we need to avoid the contradictions, and we know that our epistemic systems always involve some kind of contradictions and oppositions, then we need a kind of bigger picture.
I'm conscious of the time, and we have people might want to get back to their hotels and in order to come back for the film. And we do have three other panel sessions and the final synthesis session to continue the discussions. So back here at 8 o'clock for the film. Otherwise, tomorrow morning, coffee will be available from 9 o'clock. And we want to start, we'll try to start promptly at 9:30. So thank you, everybody, and hopefully see you at 8 o'clock. Thank you.